Well, thank you all for being here this morning to share the Dharma together. Today is Zazen Kai, our one-day session. Some of you are here for the entire day, some for part of the day. But however long you are here, as Yasutani admonishes us in the session cautions, give yourself up to the session. Give yourself up to the sitting, to the move, to the breath. Give up yourself. If you do need to shift your posture during the Taisho, that's fine. But please do so quietly and mindfully. And however you sit, keep the back straight and the head up. The Bodhisattva way to save all beings, all that breathes and does not breathe. And how do we do this? By letting go. Letting go of what? Letting go of the separate, isolated self. And how do we do that? By seeing it clearly. And that's the hard part. Seeing the self clearly. Seeing all the hidden assumptions, images, preconceptions that make up this thing we call ourself. And even when we see it, the letting go can be difficult, sometimes even frightening. This morning we'll take a look at a part of case number 20 in the 300 cases of Master Dogen. Dado Lori's translation of this case reads, Zhang Sha was once asked by the emperor's secretary, Du, when you chop up an earthworm into two pieces, both pieces keep moving. I wonder, in which piece is the Buddha nature? Zhang Sha said, don't have illusory thoughts. Du said, how are we to understand that they are both moving? Zhang Sha said, understand that air and fire are not yet scattered. Du said, nothing. Zhang Sha called, Du. And Du responded, yes. Zhang Sha said, isn't this your true self? Du said, apart from my answering, is there another true self? Zhang Sha said, I can't call you emperor. Du said, if so, would my not answering also be my true self? Zhang Sha said, it's not a matter of answering me or not, but since the beginningless kalpa, the question to answer or not has been the root of birth and death. Then he recited a verse. Students of the way don't know truth. They only know their consciousness up to this moment. Recognize this as the foundation of birth and death, which the deluded call the original self. All we know about Zhang Sha is that he died in 868 of the Common Era, and that he was a Dharma heir of Nanchuan, and therefore a Dharma brother of Zhao Zhou. There is much to explore in this koan, but today I'm going to focus on just the verse. Those who have worked on case number 12 in the Wu Men Guan will remember this as the verse to the case Ru Yen calls master. But Wu Men got it from Zhang Sha, who lived a couple of centuries earlier. Quite a few of the verses in the Great Koan collections were taken from older sources. This particular verse is one of the most significant in all of the Zen literature. It goes to the very heart of our delusive existence in time, space, and karma. Students of the way don't know truth. They only know their consciousness up to this moment. Recognize this as the foundation of birth and death, which the deluded call the original self. Students of the way don't know truth. That's truth with a capital T, or maybe truth in all caps. This truth that Zheng Xia is talking about is not truth as opposed to falsehood. Another name for it is prajna, transcendent wisdom. But what kind of truth is that? Is there a truth that cannot be known? Is there a dharma that has never been taught? Lao Tzu said, "The Tao that can be known is not the real Tao. The name that can be spoken is not the real name." They only know their consciousness up to this moment. We think we know ourselves, that we know who we are. But how do I know who I am? How do any of us know who we are? Where does this kind of knowing come from? The knowing that we are most familiar with, that we use to create ourselves, comes from the past, from our consciousness up to this moment. If you are asked who you are, who you really are, how do you reply? "My name is..." And where did that name come from? "My parents named me after my grandfather or an uncle or an aunt." If you are interested in getting to know someone, what do you ask? "Where did you come from? Where were you born? Where did you grow up, go to school? What was your first job? Are you now or have you ever been?" It's all about the past, our consciousness up to this moment. Every job interview I ever went to, every application I ever filled out, has been about the past. When we know the past, our past or someone else's, we think we know them in the present and even in the future. We think we know ourselves in the present and the future. It is as if time were a straight line on a graph, and if we connect the dots, the line will come from the past, through the present, and project into the future. Thus, this past is the very basis of our reality. Why would we not think that it is ourself? When something bad happens, we want to blame the past. Or if something good happens, we want to credit the past. This is happening because that happened. I'm in financial trouble because I didn't buy Microsoft at 5. That is what karma is all about, the law of cause and effect. We tend to look at the past as something immutable, fixed, over and done with, water under the bridge. And since the past is fixed, we feel it can and should be fully known, or at least it's knowable. Historians seem to think so. They look for the definitive set of facts. What really happened? But the unexpected always crops up. And we have this peculiar faith that it was unexpected only because we didn't have enough information about the past. If only I'd known. What does that mean? That your crystal ball was on the fritz and it's your fault? If we misremember, make mistakes, we assume that our memory is at fault. After all, if the past is fully fixed and knowable, it must be our fault that we didn't get it right. There's that old, kind of an old saw story about law school class, where the instructor is lecturing about eyewitness testimony. Suddenly something happens. A man bursts into the classroom, followed by another man. The first man shouts out something. The second pulls out a pistol and fires a shot. And then they both run out of the room. The instructor immediately asks the students to write down exactly what happened. Then the papers are collected and read aloud. The accounts are so different, it is hard to believe that everyone saw the same staged event. The point, of course, is to show how unreliable the memory of eyewitnesses can be. There's an experience that I've had a few times. I go to a movie, and I really enjoy it. Wow, what a great movie. And there's this one scene that was terrific. So I go to the same movie a week or so later, and here comes that scene that I like so much, and it's completely different from what I remembered. So what is memory? Is it a kind of archival record that we search for aspects of the past, of ourselves? And if we mess up, is it really the memory at fault? Or is it that maybe, just maybe, the past is not quite as immutable as we thought? If memory is our only connection with the past, and I think we all know from experience how changeable and unreliable that is, what does that say about the past itself? And if the past is changeable, how can we rely on it for a prop for the self? Now, we could say that, after all, there is documentary evidence of the past. Historians keep coming up with new stuff, more information. What does that new stuff do to our past? It changes it. More new stuff, a different past. Are we then different? A few years ago, my brothers and I traveled up to Sheridan, Wyoming, to see where our father was born. The house is still there, and we learned all sorts of things about his family and our ancestors that we didn't know before. It turns out we had ancestors on both sides of the Johnson County War, a conflict between the cattle barons and small ranchers. One in the family had the reputation as a gunfighter. Did that new knowledge change who I am? People, including me, love to brag about ancestors who came over on the Mayflower or whatever, who fought in this or that war, who held what political office, received this or that honor, and on and on. If I find out about my past or my family's past, maybe I will know who I am. How many movies, novels, television series center upon people searching out secrets of their past, and how the discoveries bring about changes in the person? Some good, some not so good. Suppose you research the life of a distant ancestor who was a sea captain. That sounds pretty neat, till you find out that he was the captain of a slave ship. Or you research your mother's family and in the process learn that she was not your mother. Does any of that change who you are? And should it? We use the past as a source of ongoing pride, or we can use it as a source of ongoing guilt and shame. Either way, it's about bolstering a self. It's strange that this separate ego self will cling to the most monstrous memories, sometimes even preferring them to the more pleasant ones. It's not about good memories or bad memories. It's about those that we can cling to, those that powerfully reinforce the separate ego self. It's a kind of lifeline. Even in the most guilt-ridden and shameful recall, there is comfort. This is me. I exist. But our memories of the past are as changeable as the weather, only faster. What are we doing with all those memories, all those facts about ourselves? We are picking and choosing every moment. We pick and choose those memories that create and reinforce the separated ego self. We use the past to bolster an identity, and we cling to the parts. We view and review them over and over. We fantasize about them and invent 100 alternative scenarios. But here's the question. Do we look at a past and use it to create a self? Or do we create a self and then select out and cling to those bits of the past that support the self we have created? Probably a bit of both. Recognize this as the foundation of birth and death that the deluded call the original self. All those memories, the recalls, the reliving are the foundation of birth and death. The deluded call it the original self. If all we know of the self is our consciousness up to this moment, and that consciousness changes like quicksilver moment by moment, what does that say about any notions of a continuing, stable self? If we cling to the past as though we're that straight timeline, if we accept its reality, we become a complete slave of the past. Once the line is drawn, the direction established, there can be no deviation. In Moby Dick, Captain Ahab cries out, "The path to my fixed purpose is laid with iron rails whereon my soul is grooved to run. Over unsounded gorges, through the rifled hearts of mountains, under torrents' beds unerringly I rush. Naught's an obstacle, naught's an angle to the iron way." Hoo boy. Talk about karma to the max. This is the ultimate in determinism. And it is the result of according a special reality to the past and clinging to it. Do our thoughts and memories about the past really point to something that is back there? Is there a past that exists apart from this moment? If it really is apart from this moment, not this moment, but somewhere else, then it is unknowable and not worth bothering with. The Buddha said, "Look how he abused me and beat me, how he threw me down and robbed me. Live with such thoughts and you live in hate. Look how he abused me and beat me, how he threw me down and robbed me. Abandon such thoughts and live in love." How do we abandon such thoughts? If the past is genuinely existent as a metaphysical reality, that would be impossible. It happened. We can't pretend it didn't. We cannot deny or abandon it any more than Ahab could. It would be self-deception. But what is the real deception? It is the notion of an existing past. We have to be careful here. When powerful and persistent memories arise, memories of horrific, traumatic events, abuse, suffering, and loss, how do we deal with them? It's too easy to say just ignore them. There are times when one must do psychological work in order to help us reconcile ourselves to this past, whatever it is. We try to come to some kind of acceptance, forgiveness of ourselves and others. But that is only a step. Eventually, we have to let it all go. If this past exists, if we take it as a reality, then the process of recall, remembrance, forgiveness, reconciliation will be never-ending. As long as we look at the past as existing outside of the now, like the historian, the ego self will always be able to come up with more stuff to remember, forgive, and on and on and on. The evaporated past has no more reality than the evanescent present or the unarrived future. Memory, thoughts of the past, are just that. Thoughts that arise only in this moment. They refer to nothing but themselves. The popular concept of karma comes from the giving of a spurious reality to the past and then acting out of that reality. Nagarjuna said, "The wheel of becoming, i.e. cause and effect, is produced by the propensity for erroneous imagination." A piece of wood arises in this moment. And with it arises all of its past and future. A cup arises in this moment. And with it arises its past and future. You yourself arise in this moment and all your past and future. Mind arises in this moment and with it arises all past and all future. A piece of wood passes away in this moment. And with it passes away all of its past and future. The cup passes away in this moment. And with it passes away its past and future. You yourself pass away in this moment. And all your past and future passes away. Mind passes away in this moment. And with it all past and all future passes away. There is no arising separate from passing away. No passing away separate from arising. Time itself is an illusion created by looking at arising and passing away as separate processes. This is how we understand time. The only way we can see the great reality of our Buddha nature is to see beyond past, present, and future. That is to let go of any differentiation between past, present, and future. This is pretty hard. The past is our anchor, our solid, enduring reality. "No, no, they can't take that away from me," says the song. But while it may be an anchor, it is also a prison. Letting go is to drop the 1,000-pound burden. It is to become light and easy in the four parts of the body. All we have is the reality of this moment, which doesn't abide. It is only when we extract past and future as separate from this moment and act out of that delusive separation that we get into trouble. If we deal with just the here and now, we take away the power of karma. Sufficient unto the moment is the evil, or the good, or the joy, or the sorrow thereof. Case number 80 in the Blue Cliff record reads, A monk asked Zhao Zhou, "Does a newborn baby possess the six senses or not?" Zhao Zhou said, "It's like a ball bouncing on swift flowing water." The monk later asked Tou Zu, "What is the meaning of a ball bouncing on swift flowing water?" Tou Zu said, "Moment by moment, it flows on without stopping." What a wonderful metaphor. Can we dance along the swift flowing river of our lives with no resistance whatever? There is nothing to hold, nothing to carry, nothing to cling to. A mirror does not cling to reflections. We cannot cling to our own shadow. One of the most important exercises in our every minute Zen training that we do here at the center is to look carefully at all our thoughts, emotions, etc., and see them arise and pass away and cling to none of them. It's not easy. We are asking ourselves to cut loose the anchor of the past and let ourselves float on moment-to-moment reality. This is taking refuge in Buddha. Students of the way do not know truth. We cannot know truth, not in the usual way. Not even the Buddha knows. We can only know our consciousness up to now. That's okay as long as our knowing is in accord with the unknowable. How? Pay attention. In your zazen, just see the past clearly, moment by moment. Observe the thoughts, memories arising and passing away. Observe the unspoken, unacknowledged assumption about the reality of what we label as past. Do not cling to this version or that. All the memories, the guilt, the pride, arise only in this moment. They arise as this moment. Thought after thought arises in mind. Thought after thought is not separate from mind. Each moment itself is mind. I would change that last bit. If we say each moment, it tends to rouse thoughts of moments in a sequence. No. This moment itself is mind. This moment is all there is. It is when we see clearly in this moment that mystery arises, wonder arises, and compassion and gratitude arise. The miracle of being arises. Every atom of dust, every ray of sun, every sound, every sight and touch is a great awakening. The world is made new in this moment. How wonderful. How can we not be grateful, joyous, and free? Together with all beings, we realize the way.